This is Erin Cunniff interviewing Judy Smith on March 7th, 2002 for the Montana Feminist History Project in the Women's Studies Department of the University of Montana. Okay, so could you tell me about how you initially got involved with feminism or feminist activism in general?
One interesting thing is when I first got involved, we didn't call it feminism. That came later. We called it women's liberation, because I was part of the social liberation movements of the 60s, and the word feminism wasn't something that was part of our vocabulary. Later on, we realized we were the multiple wave of all these things that women had been doing, but at that time, it didn't seem to us to flow that way. So we talked about it as what was going on with women within the context of like the anti-war movement and the student movement in Austin, Texas, where I was in graduate school. So in the 60s, when we were organizing for a lot of change for lots of other folks, including the civil rights movement, this is the classic story. A lot of us were doing that work and going, well, we're talking about freedom and rights and treating people like full human beings and equality, and yet women are treated the same old way. And so there was a rather thorough discussion in Austin, because Austin was one of the major places for the student movement. And there was a rather thorough discussion there of what was going on in that movement, and a group of women basically saying, well, we're not interested in being part of this anymore. And so we broke off and started our own movement. And that happened all around the country. One of the more interesting things I think about the women's liberation movement of that time is that it was parallel evolution. The same thing was going on in lots of kind of hot spots around the country. So you'd find out in Madison, you'd find out in Berkeley, you'd find out in Harvard, you'd find out in wherever it is, that where there were quite a few campuses where there was a large student movement going on, this same phenomenon occurred, which is the women that were involved in those political change conversations just said, whoops, nope, not doing this anymore. And it caused a fair amount of, well, it still does. I think it would be always interesting to ask some of the men from that period how they feel about it. Even today, I occasionally run into a few of them, and they still have quite a bit of feeling about what that did. So for a group of us, we decided we would spend a fair number of hours with each other talking over the whole concept of what it meant to be a woman, and how'd you grow up being a woman, and what'd you feel about it, and that was called the consciousness raising groups. And again, it was a kind of a spontaneous evolution. No one told us how to do that. It was just, okay, let's all get in someone's backyard and talk over sexism and socialization and the meaning of the things that we've been taught and what we want to do about it. So that was one thread that was really important for me. A second thread is that I'm trained in a particular field, and that's sort of played directly into the whole birth control and abortion movement, because I had some training in that area. I was in graduate school in biology, and at that time, basically, it was hard to get birth control pills, and it was very hard to get a legal abortion, because basically in Texas it was illegal. There were very few places it was legal. So a group of us decided we'd start making birth control and abortion available. And we didn't provide the actual abortion, but we did take women places that they could get abortions. And my colleagues and I in the graduate program at the biology department went down and investigated the clinics and made sure that they were safe and made sure they used sterile technique and all those kinds of things. So we took on a certain responsibility around birth control and abortion at that time. And again, I think when you have your own experience of something being illegal that you think you absolutely have a right to, that's a radicalizing experience. And you can go in various directions with it, but at that time, at least in the late 60s, most of us went in the direction of saying, I have the right to that, I'll have it. And so we worked at different levels. We did some legal challenges. We did, as I say, direct access kinds of things. We did quite a bit of education. And it just worked out that I was part of the group that brought a court case that ended up being the Roe versus Wade case, and so we went to the Supreme Court and won that particular case. But I think more importantly than that was just the sense of it that we were very, entitled. And I think that's something that's always interesting to ask, who gets involved in what part of the women's movement when. So it was a lot of women with quite a bit of education, quite a bit of sense of themselves that they should have what they want. And so the issues that came from that are issues that are pretty predictable. Women wanted sexual freedom, okay? Women wanted equal rights to jobs that pay money, okay, women, those kinds of things. So those are the first issues that kind of rolled out of that part of the women's movement. And because it was a student-based movement, those are the kinds of conversations a lot of us had. But also, interestingly, because of other political philosophy that I had, I spent a lot of time over in the minority side of town, which is where a lot of the Hispanic and African-American folks lived. So I got very involved in poverty issues as well. But I can't say that the Austin women's movement did. That just happened to be a interest of mine. So for me anyway, after all that kind of happened and I finished up my degree and I wanted to move somewhere, and at that time I was pretty alienated from Austin because it was growing quickly and I didn't want to live in a city. And I had come backpacking up here. And there was sort of an ethic at that time of going back to the land. A lot of folks that I've met who came to Montana when I did in the 70s moved to Montana because they wanted to be here closer to the clean air, water, the mountains, create their own community, live as a part of, you know, a better environmental relationship. So a lot of folks moved here. I was one of them. Moved to Missoula, and I was interested in the fact that there was a university here because I figured that's how I could make a living, would be to figure out how to do some teaching at the university. And I had done some teaching at the university where I just gotten my degree. So I thought maybe I could come up and propose teaching some of the classes and some of the things I did there. So, and also they had an underground newspaper here, and I had worked for my years as a graduate student in the underground newspaper called The Rag, which was the local sort of, you know, subversive newspaper of the time. The Independent now has nothing really, it's very different than what we did with the Underground Press, because the Underground Press considered itself accountable to the movement. The Independent and these papers right now, there's no movement to be accountable to, but at that time it was a very different relationship. So I worked on that, and there was one here called The Borrowed Times. So I had heard about Missoula. So there were just some things in Missoula that made me think, well, that might be a place I could go live and do some of the things I want to do, and it's not a city, and it's close to the mountains. So I moved here in 73. And spent about 3 months in the library trying to see if there was anything about women in the library here. There was very little. And I just sort of poked around just to see what was going on here and talked to some people. And this is sort of the funny part. I asked about who'd been doing what on campus, and I'd heard, well, there were a couple people who'd been doing some things on campus. Carolyn Wheeler's name came up, who had been in the English department and had done some courses and had worked in the Women's Center. And Diane's name came up, but what was so funny about Diane's name is that people said I should probably talk to her and meet her, but when I did, she was totally negative to me. She said, nothing can happen here. We've done whatever there is to be done in Missoula. Don't even bother. I was like, that's interesting. So she wasn't a part of my life very much early on, because what I brought was a focus also on the whole birth control and abortion thing. And so when I came in, I tried to find the women who were working around those issues and said, look, I want to start a clinic. So I want to talk to you about starting a women's clinic here. And then I also said to the women on campus, look, I want to teach women's studies. So I want to do that here. So how do we do those things? And there wasn't a women's center. So I said, well, let's just start a women's center. And again, there's a certain pattern to all of this, because like I say, I think many of us who got involved in this wave of the, you know, women's movement were very entitled women. Like, we just said, you know, there should be this. So we walked over to the UC and there was an empty space and it was an old cafe. And we just said to Ray Chapman, who happened to be the head of the UC at that time, we'll take that and we'll make it into a women's center. And he just looked at us and we said, you know, and then if something has to change later, that's fine. But we had some petitions. We had students and faculty and people who wanted us to be able to do that. He had no idea what it was. We just said, we'll do it. So we got that set up. And then we said, we also want to teach a women's studies class. So we proposed to teach an interdisciplinary women's studies class. And Mary Birch was one of the first allies we had, who retired from the social work department not long ago. And she sort of said, well, OK, I'll help that. And so we went to the social work department and said, sponsor this class, and we'll do it. And it'll be an interdisciplinary class, and we'll, you know, get a lot of people involved with us, and we'll advertise it. And we had lots of students who wanted to take it, and we offered it. And then we went to the faculty senate and said, look, we have a successful class, put this in the catalog and let's do it. Well, it didn't happen. But you know, it's that kind of sense of things that in some cases you can make certain things happen, in other cases you can't. And you run into certain kinds of institutions, you know, that you could have great change at certain times and not much change at all at other times. So basically what happened for me when I came here is there were some resources here, there was some flexibility here, but there was no way to make it inside the institution here. And I'm not a very institutional person, so I did a lot of things that were pretty much extra institution. And I think that was what was so disconcerting for the institution, because they didn't know what to do about that. I mean, they couldn't get rid of us, because they weren't giving, you know, they weren't paying us. So we did a lot of classes, we put on a lot of conferences, we just, you know, we had a lot of things happening, and a lot of students were involved in our projects, and different faculty folks joined us and whatever. But in some ways, the university had no real hold over us. And we can talk in more detail about some of this, but it was a very interesting experience for me, because it was an experience of saying, well, if there's an anarchist theory, I don't know, again, if you've studied political theory, but that you make the new society in the, you know, the alley or the parking lot of the old society. Well, that's kind of what we did. You know, we sort of came in here and said, there's a vacant hole over here. Let's just build this thing and show what it can be and start teaching these classes and start just do this stuff. And Diane then joined in on that after a while, because she was another one who's willing to sort of just kind of come in and do this stuff. So we created something here for, well, it was probably from 74 to 85, about 10 plus years. Significant number of students went through our classes. I actually sat on some graduate committees, which I always thought was kind of funny. you know, so by being present and being willing to just say, you know, we have something to offer and we'll offer it here, we were able to do a certain amount of something. The difficulty comes when you have to maintain that, because you don't institutionalize. It's not become part of a system, and then after a while people get too old to want to keep working for free or need health insurance or life's change or, you know, those kinds of things. So, but that's my general sense of what we were doing here on campus at that time period, is we had some very creative, skilled people who were willing to work together. And as long as we didn't have to ask the university for their approval, as long as we just could kind of move along and show the things that we were doing, and that they were very supported by the students and by some faculty, you know, there wasn't much the university was going to do about it. We got several seated jobs, so we employed people over at the Resource Center. We got a lot of work-study jobs. We set up intern programs. Some departments were much more open to working with us than others. And there wasn't any women's studies program. Social work was one of the better ones. We had, interestingly, this was the one I was always fascinated with, we had home economics. Because some of the women in home economics were very aware of all of the things that we were talking about. And they had opened up to some of the psychology people. And then education. So the classic female areas were the ones that were the most interested. And the least threatened in it, you know, because they didn't claim great academic ability. You know, when we started hitting up against the guys and their great academic, you know, fiefdoms, that was the part that was much harder to do. Sociology was helpful because of a couple people.
Mm-hmm. Who were they?
Paul Miller, Dick Vandiver, both of them were very helpful and very interested. And they would actually create classes and do independent study, and they got a lot of grief for it. Their department really gave them a very hard time for supporting us. Well, I should probably say this part. Toward the end, the school decided they did want to get rid of us, and so they investigated us, and they did a whole academic, I don't know what you call this, but anyway, they wanted to investigate us to say that we were giving credit and we shouldn't have been able to. So it was very much a witch hunt, and that language is something that, you know, some people use. And so basically this guy, McBroom, in sociology, did this little, you know, study to document, you know, that we were somehow not doing what we said we were doing, or were illegitimate, or, you know, somehow we're exploiting students and all of this. Unfortunately, there was another person involved, too, who, I'm sad to say it was Maureen Kernow, who was never very helpful. But anyway, all that happened, and so, you know, I was like, well, okay, let's see what they can document. I mean, I have no idea. But so then I went to this sort of thing when they gave their big report, and they were just totally puzzled. They were like, well, it looks like they offered these classes, and several hundred students took them, and they actually read books and wrote papers and, you know, had a big impact on them, and they did it for free. So it was that whole thing about, oh my gosh, it must be a plot. You know, it must be something, you know, subversive. We said, well, this is what we do. But by that time, for me personally, I had kind of had it with the university. You know, I was sort of like, I don't need this. So went off and did some other things. But I do think one of the most important things about the Resource Center, and I'm really glad it's still there, but I do think one of the most important things that happened there is that there was a conscious attack on it by the institution to say, there are people here that are, what's the right word? They're taking it out of just what it could be as a student thing. They're making it this larger thing. They're professional and they're, you know, bringing in resources that students wouldn't be able to bring in. So if we got them out of there, and it was just a student thing, then it would be much more controllable. And that's true. And that happened. And they tried to move it out of the UC, and they moved it out of the space, and then they, when it came back, it was tucked away in a little corner. There's just been numbers of sort of waves of experience around that. But basically then in 85, after it got really clear that there was this pressure to really close down opportunity instead of allow the opportunity to sort of continue on, a number of us just said, well, let's leave this. It can be students. There's a value to it. There is going to be a women's studies program sometime. Let it be. Let it happen, and we'll go off and do other things that we want to do. So to me, there's kind of a discrete time period there, but as I say, that we made a major effort to build something and then realized that the institution itself just didn't want to swallow us anymore, wanted to spit us out.
What was Jim Fleitner's part of it?
Well, one of my favorite things about coming over here one time, Gigi, was came to a reception and Jim Fleitner was there. Were you there at that one? And poor man. He obviously was very, humiliated almost, and he apologized, which I appreciate. I think he had finally realized that that had been such a mistake on their part, and that we had done some pretty amazing things and contributed a great deal, and that they had reacted inappropriately. So I think that was his official apology, which I appreciated. I thanked him. At least he acknowledged it.
Could you explain that?
He was the dean of the school and was involved in that whole investigation of us and sort of drumming us out of the academic hall or whatever. And he realized that was, as I say, inappropriate. Plus, there had been, I don't know if this was exactly the same time, but there had one other time kind of like that was very funny, is we had a conference here that talked about lesbianism. And at that time, there was some people in the community that got very upset about it. And there was all this conversation around how we were all witches. And I mean, all that stuff, it seems amusing, but when it is something that someone's saying about you in a community, and then the administration took it seriously. So, when your institution is susceptible to that kind of thing, that's the danger. So I got called into another dean's office to say, well, we've had a complaint about you, and I just want to have to talk to you about it. And I was like, okay, what's the complaint? Well, this person says you're a witch, and that you've talked about it on the radio. I said, well, I do talk on the radio, and I actually understand witchcraft as a experience in women's lives, and there's a history around it, but I do not consider myself a witch. I do not practice anything along that line. There's nothing like that we do in the Resource Center. There may be people like that in Missoula, but not me. And so then he apologized. I said, oh, I know, but I had to ask you that. So, it's just one of those sort of sillinesses. But it got to be very clear to me that And this is something that we were talking earlier. The campus became something different. When I was on campus in the 60s, the campus was where all political activity happened. When I came here, that was my assumption still. And as the 70s went into the 80s, I think that really changed. So I don't think campuses are where the action is anymore, for better or worse. I mean, I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that there was a shifting of that. And so as that shift happened, again, various things could happen, and there were various resources available in different ways. One of the reasons that the university did get annoyed with us is we started getting some significant grant money, because we did a lot of policy work to get money for Carl Perkins, to get some gender equity money, some things that we knew about and wrote grants and started doing, and the university almost said, well, why aren't we getting that money? Why are you getting that money? It was like, well, because we know about it. So there were just a number of issues that were sitting in there. And so in some ways, the parting of the ways was more to say, okay, well, we can create something else somewhere else that's going to be easier and have more resources for us, and then leave the university over here to do what it's going to do. And then other people came. I don't know exactly when you came, Gigi, but...
93.
Okay.
Julia Watson.
Right.
Who came in
88. Right.
The lost years are 86 to 90.
Okay. So some other people came and started to have a conversation again and wanted to do some women's projects. And so, again, it wasn't lost totally. It was just that there was a hiatus. And then some other folks came with different kind of energy. And then also women's studies became different. When I started, I mean, it's funny, but when I did women's studies, no one had been trained in women's studies. I mean, what was that? So all of us had all these different kinds of degrees and, had huge arguments, so they were kind of fun. And we had actually one of the regional women's studies meetings here, and we consciously set up interdisciplinary venues, because my training's in science, and so I had one with a philosophy person. We were just trying to show how you'd look at the same question, but with your different perspective. So we used to have a lot of fun with it. Well, there was no women's studies establishment, or degree system or anything. So again, that's another thing that's changed. So in the feminist movement, and I use that word now because I'm much more thoughtful about it, there's a whole conversation around the institutionalization of feminism and what happens, whether it's in a university, whether it's in a domestic violence shelter program. It's when something starts out as a political movement, it develops something well, then how does it move forward? Does it get institutionalized? There's certain positives to that, because there's budgets and staff and all of that, but there's also a downside to that, which is all of a sudden you have to fit someone else's credentials and structure and, you know, kind of conversation about how you should be. And so depending on who you talk to in the feminist movement, there's either a great sense of loss around that, or there's people like me who say, well, then you go on and do something else. I mean, that's fine. It got going, and then you do something else. So it kind of depends on where you find yourself at any one time. So here, that's kind of the experience that I had. The great time in the 70s in my experience here was that we did find resources. Like Margaret Kingsland was over at the Humanities Committee. I want to make sure and mention these people because I think they're very key. And she's one of these inside the system people who really wants to help those of us that are trying to push the system. And that's one of my philosophies that I still hold to, which is you got to have an analysis of inside and outside the system and how you work that together if you really want change. Well, Margaret sat as sort of holding the purse strings of the Montana Humanities Committee, and she was a feminist and she was very interested in helping. So every year for about, I don't know how many years, we would have a conference. She would help us with all kinds of projects. She was just very encouraging, and then she would also hammer on the other people that brought in their projects to say, well, where's the women's view here? What's the, because, she had us there as a constituency too, so she could do more because we were there, and we could do more because she was there. So that worked really well. And then at the state level, there was a women's bureau for a while, and a woman named Sue Bartlett that was head of that women's bureau, and there were some folks that, when the Carl Perkins programming, like I mentioned, started, they immediately came over and came to the Resource Center and said, we want you to apply for these grants because we know you'll be the people who know how to do this stuff. So there was building that kind of network all around the state of that connection of how women knew to work with each other. And I think that was the great value of what we did. And one of my favorite things now, this is a little bit related to one of these questions about the good news. One of my favorite things now is I travel around and I go to a little town and some woman comes up to me and says, oh, I took your women's studies class in 1979 and it was changed my life and we're in, and that's great because that's exactly what everybody hoped would happen. I mean, if you believe in social change at all, you have to believe that, a larger set of folks and get something different in their life, and it just pools out until all of a sudden something else can happen. And I like to say, I don't know if this is totally true because we haven't verified it, but I'd like to say that some of the things that we're able to do now, like at the state level with some of the policy work I do, is very much a result of this early work. Because a lot of women are around that we knew each other 20 years ago, and yet now they're the legislators and they're the people in the government, and some of us are still here running the nonprofit entities and whatever else. And so there's a pretty interesting set of folks in the state now. And as I say, it's not necessarily so visible. That's one of the things about the women's movement that they always say, well, where's the women's movement? If you know where to look, there's a lot going on.
Who are some of those individuals that are legislators, for example?
Well, when I said that, I was thinking very specifically of a couple people just because they're who I worked with recently. So on the welfare, I'm working on the welfare thing right now, and so Chris Kaufman's one, but Chris came over from the Resource Center with us to WIRD and then went on to, Helen and is now a legislator over there. And then Rosie Buzzis, who's here in town, represents the university, and she was on the school board for a while, and she works in flagship. Well, yeah, I think flagship. An educator, those kinds of things. Let's see, who else do I want to mention? There's a couple of Native American women that we worked with that I still see, but they weren't in the legislature this time. I'm trying to think who else would be. This is going to be bad. See, I'm not going to remember all these names.
Just one or two.
The woman who's from Crow, and I'm not going to remember her name. And well, there were a couple of women over from that sort of Crow agency area that were in the legislature. Not remembering them, their names. And then there's a woman named Karen Fenton that we used to work with pretty closely, who's now, I think, still back up on the Salish Kootenai Reservation. Jeannie Eder was someone who we used to work with over on more basically on some history and other things, not so much the legislature. I'm not going to remember the legislators' names.
Mm-hmm.
And the very good thing about that, and maybe Diane talked to you, is that when we did do the regional women's studies meetings here, one of the big things we brought to that is our insistence that Native American women would not only be included, but that we would pay someone to to actually bring them here and pay them to be here. Because in the region, there had been all this conversation around, well, we want to include, but it never really happened. And so we all got together and said, well, the way it happens is you show that you value it enough to pay people. So that was kind of a breakthrough, and that's how we connected up really well with some of those women. They came and were participants and did different workshops, and we also did an art show and very specifically recruited Native American women's art. And we said, that's not craft, that's art. And that's a distinction of the time. That may have changed now, but at a certain time, craft was not considered as valuable as art. And so some of that has shifted now, I think. So we got to know some of those folks. So that created some good bonds. And see, I think personally, that's what the university should be about. I mean, talk about using resources. I mean, that's what you use the resources that are in a place like this to do, is to reach out and create things that can't happen. Bring into different sets of people and different experiences and put something that weaves together. You can't do that as easily other places. The university is, I think, really uniquely valuable for that. So we were able to do that for a couple of years. And you may all still be doing it. I don't mean to say it's not now, but just that at that time. That's kind of what we did. And there was a core of people, again, some faculty people who worked on that, certainly a number of graduate students that have gone on and done other things, worked on that. And then, as I mentioned earlier to you, Erin, the other programs that we had started in the community, like Blue Mountain Clinic and Women's Place, those really fed in and out of the Resource Center because we would recruit there for students who'd want to work in the different organizations. We'd do educationals. There was a lot of flow through because there was a core of women that would be involved in several of those. Since my particular interest was in that, I was involved in all of them. But some other people would be involved in one or two or three of them. And so again, there was that flowing around of people that were interested. So we always had something new, a new brown bag topic at the Resource Center. One time it would be history, and then the next time it would be reproductive because we'd want to do that. And then we might want to do health, and we might want to do blah, blah, whatever it was. You know, we just would be constantly flowing in those other issues. And we did assertiveness. These are the little things like I can remember, too. We were the first people to do assertiveness training. We did it, of course, from a feminist perspective. And then other people picked up assertiveness, and it became sort of a standard conversation. But, you know, that was a feminist tool right early on. We did the first divorce survival workshops, and we did a divorce survival handbook. I don't know if Diane talked too much about this, but because of my sister Lynn, who was a printer, we got into self-publishing a lot, and because we worked on the rag, we really believed you have to get information out to people. And on some level, by the way, I think we were very naive, but that's another issue. So we thought if you just got people the right information in their hands, right, then they would, you know, do something. So we did a lot of printing. So we, you know, did the birth control handbooks, we did the divorce handbooks, we did a career change handbook, we did...
They locked up the birth control handbooks, didn't they?
Well, there was a lot of things that happened with that. Yeah. Diane has that story about that one. That's the McGill handbook from Texas days. We used that same one. That's one of the things Diane and I have laughed about, because we, in Texas, were having our same stuff using that same handbook that the school down there hated us using, and she was up here, and the school was hating her using it here. That's the kind of synchronicity I mean about what was going on at the time. There was just so much going on, you know, and so it's been fun to kind of check into that and see. So anyway, we just published a lot of things. That newsletter that Gigi brought in, that we were really committed to having that, and you can see the range of topics, and a lot of the things we were up to were in that. So it was very wide-ranging, and as a result of that, we had a lot of different kinds of women involved with us. Like, we had the first woman who was a forester who went through the forestry school. I mean, just a lot of them just came in and said, well, what do you do? You know, and we'd say, well, here's what we do, and wouldn't you like to come? You know, so we had something to offer a wide range of women. It was not at all that sort of, you know, feminists are all, you know, weird and look like this stuff at that time. You know, that was, an interesting experience. It was something that I think both, I'll speak for myself and then Diana's probably said too, it was really doing women's studies in a way that probably we couldn't have done better. The trick of it is you can't maintain it, you can't sustain it. And so there's the high and the low of it.
And laying that foundation for the future program to build upon. What was it like starting things like the Blue Mountain Clinic at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Clinics for women.
Well, here's another one of my theories. If you're going to be different, you have to be really good. Because people have to overlook all the weirdness about you and kind of say, okay, you know what you're talking about. And that's one of the things that I think has helped us out here, is that a subset of us who kind of worked like at the clinic, you know, we knew what we were talking about. We were really pretty good. Barbara Burke is one of the people I met when I first moved here, and she's one of the ones I'm thinking of now. She started running Planned Parenthood. She went off to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, got her public health degree, and came back and started running Planned Parenthood, and we were friends. And I went and worked with her for a while when she would need that. And so when we started Blue Mountain, we brought half of the Planned Parenthood staff into Blue Mountain. We had a number of conversations with the health department people, because they were the more progressive edge when we were doing Women's Place around abortion. They knew we were doing abortion referral, and they knew we had that interest, and we went around and talked to a lot of them. So, again, we had a certain credibility from our background. And, you know, I'm not a big advocate necessarily of having PhD degrees, but it does help you when you're going to do this kind of stuff. So if you're going to, again, this is my argument, if you're going to be different, it's very helpful to have a credential, it's very helpful to act like you know what you're talking about, and to have people be able to go there with you. So what we did is we just shopped having a clinic. And, you know, again, we just believed it was the right thing to do. We just went to all these medical doctors, sat down in their office and said, we want to do this clinic, do you want to do it? So I went and talked to a lot of different medical people, and they were all sort of embarrassed to say no, because, you know, they realized they should do it. And that's the other thing, when you're around these people, you know, that are working with their own professional guilt and whatever, that's that we could go talk to. And all of a sudden, though, we were saying to them, come over here and work on this clinic. And, you know, I just didn't find anybody takers. But the other idea that I had was, well, if we need money, what we want to do is we'll set up notes and we'll self-finance the clinic. And I've been always into that kind of stuff, which is, you know, how do you figure out how you put resources together and, so, you know, entrepreneurship and things like that. So I went to 10 people and said, you know, give us $2,000, and then we'll write a note and we'll pay you back by a certain time. And that's how we started Blue Mountain Clinic, with that money from those people. And we went, and finally we said to this doctor, and this is the other very interesting thing that you learn, is that when you're on the edge, there's a lot of people out there with you, and some of them are out there for reasons like you are, and some of them are out there for other reasons, and you've got to sort of figure out where you can work with them and where you can't. Well, there was this doctor that was kind of out there on the edge, and he was being denied hospital privileges at one place, but we went and talked to him, and we watched him, and we thought he really knew what he was doing, so we took a doctor to open up that probably everything else being, I wouldn't have wanted to do. But that was the only way we got started. His name was Lewis, and he had, as I said, lost his privileges from one place. But it was over one of these personality things, not over his ability. We took an old room in a dental building. We made all the furniture. We cleaned it up. We went to Seattle and learned all the procedures. I wrote the standing orders for the nurses. I mean, we all just said, we're doing it. And it was in the women's health movement model, which is, you know, everybody can learn how to do these things. You just figure them out, and then if you need to have, you know, professionals, you put them where you need them, but they don't have more say than anyone else does. So it was an interesting experience, I think, for everybody, especially for the doctors. And we just did it, opened up, and started, you know, having 20 women every weekend that came in and got procedures. And I remember the very first time we did it, I mean, we just were all like, okay, here we go. Open the door. First one comes in. Sign the chart. You do this. I do this. Yeah. And so worked. We paid off the notes. You know, Blue Mountain has gone on to be what it is. And the core of women who started that, most of them didn't stay a whole long time. There was stresses and strains inside the organization for sure. And some of us stayed for a while and then left. Other people stayed a little longer and then left. And it's become more medicalized. But again, it's one of those things. It's an institution now, so what do you do? But it got started. And one of the things also that you really learn, or at least for me, I think is real important to pay attention to, is that like the women who come in and that you've done this for them, you can't really expect them to understand exactly what it is that you've done for there, and that you shouldn't have that expectation of them, because otherwise you're going to be bummed out, and they're, you know, not going to really understand why you're bummed out. Because for them, it's just like, I need an abortion. You're a place that'll provide abortion, and I want to stand there and say, do you realize what we had to go through to provide this abortion for you? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's really important, I think, historically, to watch out for that. As feminists, I think we have to be very thoughtful. So just for, like, the two of you, I can't expect you to totally understand what, you know, I did, and therefore go, oh, you did that, and I don't have to worry about it anymore. No, I mean, that's not how it's going to work. And so one of the things that interests me a lot is some of this intergenerational stuff right now, which is, you know, if there were no feminists for me to pay attention to when I was growing up, but now there are plenty of them around for other people to pay attention to, so what do you do with that? And so that's one of the things, one of my answers about Blue Mountain Clinic is, hey, there was no one there to even ask how to do it. You just said, this is how we do it. And that's the model I think we used over and over again.
What would you say we're in?
Yeah, there were significant influences probably really early on. Both my mother and father are interesting people. They grew up in fairly conservative small towns in Oklahoma and Missouri, but they both went to school in New York City. And they were both exposed to a lot of different ways of looking at things. And so we were raised in a household where people respected other people even if they were different. My father got several awards for, you know, in some ways it seems not a lot now, but at that time it was National Something for Christians and Jews and the NAACP, you know, all those kinds of things. That was just part of our life. And also the idea that differently abled people are integrated. My father was very big on kids that aren't able to do mainstream work, not being put in a corner, but brought in. So we were around all of that a lot. So I got pretty early on that message that people aren't different. People should be able to have opportunity. It's very important. And then my father's, when I think back on him, I always think I'm amused by him because he was really into the power of positive thinking. And we got that hammered on all the time. And we ate dinner together every night. And, you know, we reported on what we did in school and what, and it was like, oh, power positive thinking. Well, you just get out there and you just do this. And he was this guy with three daughters, right? So it was like, no gender issue here because it was that's what he had. And he was raised on a farm and, you know, you just went out and did everything. So we did everything. So there was a lot of that in my immediate family. And so as I grew up, you know, it was just kind of like, oh, okay, that's what you do. It's just totally supported. I never had any thought that wouldn't be the way you do it. I was always surprised when someone thought maybe it wasn't the way you did it. The other thing, and I think this is not totally good, but I mean, it's you're lucky if you do well in school. If you do well in school, people really leave you alone. So you can be as odd as you want, but you know, if you're doing really well in school, they can't do a lot to you. Well, that was my experience, especially in Texas. You know, I moved to Texas later on, and I was very different than a lot of the folks there. And that could have been harder than it was, but it wasn't because I pretty much had support of my own family, and I did well in school. One of the hardest things, though, as a result of that, is to get over the myth of meritocracy. Like, for the longest time, I kept going, God, I'm smart, and I do things well. I should get rewarded. You know? Well, no, that's not true. We don't live in a society like that, but it's hard to break that. So, anyway, but I think if you have the right kind of childhood where, you know, it's positive and people do reward you, you do think you can do anything. I mean, that's the bizarre part of this entitled experience, I think. And that's why it was hard in some ways to connect up with women for a while for me, because so few women that I ever met had this exact kind of experience. So when we do consciousness raising, my experience wasn't one that a lot of other women kind of resonated with. Plus, I'm 6 feet tall, and I've been very athletic, and I'm very verbal. You know, just all those things that, you know, are different. So that was part of it, part of the influence. My mom loved Eleanor Roosevelt, so I always keep her in my mind as someone who's probably influential. And Albert Schweitzer. My mom went to school with Albert Schweitzer's daughter. So I always heard about him. And I was very impressed by him, that he was an organist and then became a doctor, or the other way around, maybe, I can't remember which it was at first, and that he had this entire thing about respect for life, that as much as you can, you would never kill anything. So I grew up with that. You know, just those are threads that come together for me. And then when the 60s happened, it was like, whoa, look at that. There was a lot to do. So that's, to me, kind of the resource center. We could talk more about specifics if you have some in your mind that you'd like to understand more about that part of my experience here. I do think my analysis is that there were a lot of potential allies and kind of a space waiting for that to happen. So I don't believe in, like, a person like me takes credit for this. It's sort of like I had an expectation. I came in, there was all this there that it could come. You know, but sometimes that outside person with the expectation almost has to come in and stir it up a little bit, and then the thing happens. In the resource center days? Well, here's one thing that I also really believe. Even though you're not getting paid, I believe you have a schedule and you show up and you do work. And you work by example, like if lots of stuff has to get done, just because you happen to be a person that has, you know, more school or a different credential doesn't mean you don't do it all. So at the resource center, we did it all. So if there was a mailing, everybody did the mailing, or if you had to clean the floor, everybody cleaned the floor, or whatever. So we did that. Usually, couple of us would get there pretty early. We'd get a lot of phone calls, so answering the phone and fending off just inquiries and whatever. We'd usually have a meeting of some kind. It was a collective, so we, you know, meetings were long. And you'd try to decide, you know, what your programming would be or who was going to be doing what. Often enough, there'd be some excitement around some activity or something that would go on. So, you know, around lunchtime, people would come in. And my real memory of it is there'd be quiet time, but then often enough, there'd be, like, between classes or at certain times, a lot of people would just come in. And you just tell stories, and all this stuff would happen, and blah, 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 blah. And then it would quiet down again for a while. But a lot of, as I say, phone calls, people dropping by. It was kind of a clearinghouse happening in place in the best days. I mean, there were some times when it wasn't like that. Plus, we finally developed a really good library, and it was one of the only places you could find all the things that we had. So we had people in looking for books and checking things out and asking us questions pretty often, too. So usually it was pretty full with just that exchange of information and things with folks. My experience.
Was it open in the evening?
It was for classes. So we would sometimes teach our women's studies classes there and our assertiveness classes, workshops, and things like that. And then certainly when we did our conferences, it was our, you know, sort of base to work out of, and there would be a lot of things going on in there connected with it.
Did you travel from the Resource Center for Conferences?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most memorable?
Well, one of the things that is really enjoyable, and I hope you all have had a chance to do it, is to, you know, gather up a whole bunch of you and drive off somewhere to some women's conference, because you get to spend quality time with each other that you don't otherwise. So the very first time we went to the founding conference for the National Women's Studies Association in San Francisco, we went and we got a university van, and we drove it, and it was like snowing, so you could not see anything because it was in January, and so we went over the pass, Lookout Pass into Idaho, and I'm driving this, and it was like, oh no. So anyway, we do this, and when we arrive in San Francisco, everybody's like, who are you? We're like, there's a carload of women from Montana get out, and it's like, Montana's here, because it was such a, you know, again, it may not be your experience. My experience is people think most of the people in Montana are trees with no brain. So the fact that you are a Montana. So we got out, we're, you know, doing whatever we're doing, drove back the very same kind of weather, got as far as Alberton, and all the semis were off the road. All of them were off the road. So I'm driving along going, there's a message in this, Judy. Why don't you think about this? And I said, I think I'm going to get off the road. So I just angle over like this, and the car goes 360 all the way around, and we're all like, ah. So we stayed in the motel in Alberton on the way back. But the greatest thing to me is that there were like, oh, I don't know, eight of us maybe, just going to those conferences and realizing, oh my gosh, there are all these women all over the country. They're doing all these things. They may not even be interesting, but they're doing them. You know? So, you know, enjoy that and listen to it. And each time you'd go, you'd have a new thing. You'd come back and say, oh, you know what, I heard these people are organizing because fat is a feminist issue. You go, fat is a feminist issue? What is that? And then after a while, another year, you'd be saying, oh, there's this body workshop that everybody's doing around fat, blah, blah. So, you know, you just listen to it, and all of a sudden it would become this whole analysis and something that would, you know, be worked on. So it made up for living in Montana to some degree, because, you know, Montana's totally out of it. So it was kind of like, okay, if you go these places, you could actually get content, and then you can come back, and the great thing about Montana is that you can then do something with the content, because, you know, there's some flexibility here. You're not locked into certain rigidities because no one owns the territory yet here. So you can say, okay, let's do that here. And that was very good. We did travel every year for a while. We try to go to those National Women's Studies meetings. And depending on who you talk to, they'll tell you those are memorable in some way or another.
And you hosted some
National. Yeah, we hosted, right. We hosted the regional one, and then we certainly had a range of other kinds of conferences that were statewide conferences as well.
Did you get any resistance to the conferences that you hosted or the topics that you were dealing with in consciousness raising?
Well, like I mentioned, the university got unhappy with us when the community heard we were talking about lesbians. That was like a problem, and the university, in my opinion, was totally inappropriate because they kind of apologized for that to the community, which I think is you should never be doing. Other than that, no, not really.
With the women in technology or
right, no.
Bodies?
No, you know, because to some degree, again, we weren't asking to be accepted in the middle. We were acknowledging that we were a pretty unique track. We had things that were important to raise, and we were in conversation, but we didn't ask to be, you know, yeah, this is the middle road. We didn't look for that. We were willing to be on the edge. So, you know, if you're on the edge, get your own money, bring up your own things. People aren't too unhappy with you. And also, you know, again, like, let's take the technology there were a lot of people around the country that were talking about the things we were talking about. It isn't as though it was just this little group of women in Montana. It's just that no one else in Montana necessarily was talking about that. So, you know, people heard about it other places.
So I wanted to ask you about your involvement of getting women involved in different studies, for example, the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm. So again, in the early conversations in women's studies, some of the academic areas that came up very early were like the English and social work and history. You know, women started saying, okay, let's study women and let's understand women. And then the areas that for a while there was almost no activity would be the more traditional science and technology areas. And everybody would say, well, what's there to do in here? Like, you know, it's science, so women would do it the same way men would do it, or there'd be the same answer to the equation or whatever. And so a number of us, and this was a nationwide conversation, said, well, maybe not. Maybe it actually would be done differently if women did it. Maybe they'd ask different questions. Maybe they'd approach it with a different perspective. Maybe they're not even interested in some of the things that are valued now because it's a male, whole male approach to things. So let's ask questions about that. And there were a number of women, most of them, again, in science departments that began to deconstruct some of this. Also began to say, well, what is the role of women in science? Like, there's a lot of women and then they drop out at certain key times. Why do they drop out there? What's going on in science that makes them drop out? And then there was a conversation around computers. This has changed a little bit, I think, but I had a very good friend who ended up, now she teaches women in technology in Canada, because Canada actually has a very interesting support for that kind of study on the whole question about women in technology. And what her theory was is that young women weren't becoming engaged with the computers because of the way computers were taught. So, you know, the games that had so much violence and the imagery that was used with computers, it just was alienating to little girls. Plus, they wouldn't fight to get on it. So if you only had one or two computers in a room, the little boys would get them and the little girls would not. Well, now some of that's changed so that there's a computer for everyone, so there's not that same gender activity. Plus, some of the learning techniques have changed. So it'll be interesting to see if women do engage computers, but for a while they weren't as much. So there's been a lot of conversation around that, which is, like, I could tease you and say, why didn't you know how to work that particular piece of machinery? You know, like a guy would know that. Well, there's a certain choice that we would make too, not to engage with machinery. What's that about? And I used to always use this example about kitchens, which is, you know, there's incredible technology in kitchens. And women all engage that technology. They get in there and they do all this stuff with the technology, but that's okay, right? Because that's in a kitchen. But if you took them out and put them in somewhere else, they would not engage at all the same way. So, you know, there's that whole issue of perception and desire and all that you have to begin to think about and talk about too. So it's an interesting area. I always say, you know, if you had many lives, I would have had one in that whole area. I have a PhD in science. I would have, you know, gone along a line. I would have probably done more research. I would have asked more of those questions and probably be doing something along there, but I didn't pick that path. But there's some certainly interesting things in there. And there are people doing it. Like, I understand there's a woman here on this campus now in physics who wants to write a WEA grant. Do you know about this? Has she approached you? Yeah, I don't know her.
She's moving to Bozeman because her husband has a job there, but she will be tenure track at Bozeman.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So she wants to do this, and she's identified, she thinks one of the problems for young women is the fourth and fifth grade teachers, right? So she wants to engage them in how to do inquiry-based learning. And you know, so you know, that continues on as part of the whole thing.
And because it's still Montana,
right,
you can still work with her.
Right, yeah, that's true. That's true. So. And, you know, I think while we're on the women's studies thing, I do think one of the key things that's been of interest to me about women's studies is the one we just talked about, which is women's studies just about finding out what women do and just adding them into this sort of established way of looking at things? Or is it actually saying, no, let's look at things completely differently? And that's been a struggle. Like Gilligan's work, are you familiar with her? Although I don't totally like her work, there's something in her work that I really appreciate, which is that women really have different values and they have different ways of approaching things, and if you change your frame and look at it that way, would reality really be different? I mean, those are just engaging questions, and that's what the university's for, in my opinion. You know, when I'm at Word and I'm sitting there trying to figure out what to do about welfare, I don't get to sit very long and say, well, let's see, do women really think about it differently? I mean, that's not on my plate. So it's great to have places that where it is on your plate and try to say, okay, what do we know about that, and how do we then learn what we do? It's not enough just to know, but what we do about that. So if women have a different value system, how do we get that value system in place? So people like me, they're doing welfare reform, say, look, the value system is that. We which would actually then work better for me under welfare reform, in my opinion. So, you know, it's that linkage of academic understanding and work with the actual political, practical work that women's studies originally started out being about. I don't know if it stayed there. That's a question that a lot of people ask. But.
Are there any other fields you can think of that did that?
Well, didn't sociology to some degree do that? And I bet anthropology might want to argue it does that, but sociology, at least certain sociology people, would say that they started asking questions around social problems because they wanted to understand them and then help provide solutions for people in the field with them. Of course, social work would want to argue that at least part of what they do is ask questions to get information that, you know, allow you to set up programs that address things in society.
What about the sciences?
Well, I'm cynical about that. See, I think to some degree the way you're trained when you're in an academic science program is not to be of use. I think it's to ask intellectually rigorous questions that engage you and your colleagues. And if it happens to be of use, because then you can get some money for it. It may have changed now. You know, again, I was in school a while ago, and it may be that because of funding, you know, business interest is there, and you better show business interest what it is that you have that's of use to them. So maybe that's happened. But in general, no, I don't think so. You can think of examples where that's not true. Like, you know, Louis Pasteur looking at his little mold to see that it was going to cure something.
We're still wondering what would bring women's studies here after 10 years into dialogue with the sciences.
Well, you know, there's two things I've really noticed that has happened. One thing that's happened is if you get enough students in there that are women, like that's happened in sociology and some of these other programs where almost the whole student body became women, then all the faculty are men, and then you try to point that out to them and you help them say, okay, maybe something has to happen in this exchange differently. So I don't know if that's happened very much yet in the sciences here, but in some places there's a significant number of women that are, especially biological, ecological, natural history-based science, I bet there's quite a few women. So that would be one thing, is just that there'd be volume of women in the classroom that would be a basis for something. Then, of course, there's these key women that take faculty positions and begin to have some influence at that level and say, the trick is they have to be willing to say it, though. See, if they won't acknowledge that they think women's studies or feminism or whatever is important, then they're almost like a hindrance to you, because it's kind of like, oh, I made it, and you can too. And I don't know, again, who's in the departments here. I do know that for a while there were a couple of even some of the men in the biological sciences that were very interested in, you know, if we had had a way of paying our way, some of us who had this training could have probably gone in and made more change there. But, you know, we would have had to do it for free, and that didn't engage me. But I do think that's still there. I do think that some of the men themselves have some interest in this. It's just that how do you get inside that conversation?
Is there a parallel to some of the programs that Word has initiated in male-dominated realms, like home building and finance loans?
Oh yeah. One of the parallels that's very clear is that what we've done out in the community is just like we did here, is we said, okay, we know how to do something, we'll set it up, we'll show you it works, and then we want you to do it too. That's the, you know, creating a model and based on your own principles. So when we started the whole microloan business analysis, we said, you know, women often can't get credit. They often don't start businesses because they don't have access to resources and they want to start small and banks don't want to loan to them and they're overlooked. And there's a whole arena for how someone could employ themselves at a small micro business and they could get resources and maybe eventually employ one or two others but never create a big business. And that's something that's of value. So let's create a program that promotes that. And so we did, and we got money to do that, and we targeted women and low-income people. And again, it's one of those ones where we showed how it worked, and now someone else does it, because it does work. So it's the same model to a large degree of being able to demonstrate something, prove it up, you know, and kind of say, okay, why don't you try it? Now with housing, we're also doing something similar, although we haven't quite yet hit a point where we have women contractors. You know, a lot of what we're doing, we conceive of it, we bring the neighborhood in, we have some really neat things going on, but we're still having to hire pretty much male contractors. However, they do like working with us. Like the architects will overwhelmingly say they'd like to do our projects. The contractors like to do our projects. So they consider us innovative. and that's positive to them, and they want to work with us. And we had, one of the first things we did do is, if you get a contract with us to build a house, you have to employ a certain number of women in your crew. It's right there in the language. And that was the first time that was done, that we know of in Montana anyway. And that's okay. You know, they're willing to do that. You know, it's just a little chipping away a little bit at some of that. So, but see, that's that parallel where you have the cards. See, here on this campus, you guys don't have very many cards still. But we do. We have the money to build the house. They better listen to us. So, you know, that's one of the difficulties, I would say, probably over here, is some women's studies programs have gotten the president or the, you know, administration people to kind of say, you're going to do it. I don't know if that's happened here enough. I just don't know.
I think it's an interesting analysis about resources and models. Mm-hmm. And on the model front, I think that is what works. Mm-hmm. If you show a successful model to anyone, and you happen to be the women's studies program, then and people have a positive experience, it doesn't matter what department they're from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you have to show them a successful model. And the second way to go is to have the resources to call the shots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, again, we in most cases we're the model. A few cases we're the resources. And that's another thing I always say in right now, we're doing this thing of, well, okay, what do we do? There's shifts in funding and shifts politically, and I'm always saying, okay, where's a place we can model something? Where's an openness for us? Because, you know, you don't want to go head-to-head against established things because, again, if you're different, it's very hard to go head-to-head. So you go into an area that's open where you can try out something new and then demonstrate it back. That's what we did with the Family Resource Centers. There were no Family Resource Centers here. So, you know, if you look over and over again, that's the same model that we're using. It's like, okay, here's something we can show you needs to happen. We can even, you know, bring it to you and negotiate with you. Schools haven't really picked it up. We're going to see. Barb's going to try to get them. In a couple weeks, there's going to be a meeting to see if they'll all at least pay $2,000 for each one to have a family advocate in the resource centers.
To transition mm-hmm. over to
mm-hmm. So that's still in process. I'm going to need to go in just a few minutes because I have something at 7 downtown I've got to walk over to. But any last thing that comes to your mind for this part?
Just sort of closing up, you know, is there anything that you wish you did differently, or what do you think was the most important thing that you've left in your trail for women like myself?
You know, I don't really have anything I would have done differently, which is fortunate. one of the skills I think I have is starting things and then leaving them. And not feeling like I have to own them, but letting them evolve and feel good and encourage. And I think that's what I would say I have done, is that there's many institutions that are based around a feminist analysis that I've helped start and can let go and say, okay, fly off here, see what it's going to be and what you're going to do. So I like that role. The hardest part about that role is getting older. This is something that we chat about, which is, you know, when you're in your 50s, it's a little different than when you're in your 20s and 30s. So then you can't just keep starting and flying off here. You got to figure out some other thing that's going to happen. And so one of the things I've done in the last couple of years at Word even is to try to really draw back and say, look, I'm only going to do certain things now. I'm going to be gone here. Other people have got to figure this out. Other people got to move this organization where it's going to go. I mean, I'll be here. I'm a resource person. I'll help you out. But, you know, I'm not the engine anymore. And someone else is going to be the engine, or a group of you are going to be the engine. Because I want to go over here and do policy, you know. It's not retiring. I don't mean it that way. But it's just like, I don't want to be in there in the same way that I have been. I want to be over here. So that's a struggle to try to get that to work. But that needs to happen. And like I said, with the generation thing, Word consciously employs 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings, and 50-somethings. And that's a goal of ours. Because mm-hmm. that conversation has to go on in a constructive way. And we actually do that purposely with each other. Like, we have little sessions where we say, okay, what do the 20-somethings want to say to the 50-somethings? And blah, blah, blah. And those are fun. Because, you know, they're beginning to understand differently about things that way. And I think that's the only way a movement stays alive. You just know to have that flow of communication back and forth. So we work on that at Word, and I think that's another thing I'm really glad of.
Does Word have Take Your Daughter to Work Day?
We did for about three or four times. And then for whatever reason, the mothers decided they didn't want to continue doing that, but we definitely did do it for a while. And we have a lot of kids. It's interesting. A lot of people's, you know, children come to work on some fairly regular basis, and that's another thing. Sometimes we want to talk about Word in one of these interviews. We definitely try to think very clearly about what's our family-friendly policy, because that's one of the things that we think makes us a feminist work environment. You know, and we talk like how do you be a feminist work environment? Well, most women are going to have kids of some sort at certain times, and how do you make that work for them and for the work environment? And I think there was a certain naivete at the beginning, like, well, you can bring your kid anytime, and oh, it's always, well, and then it was like, no, you can't bring your kid. So how do you negotiate all that and, you know, have it be a positive experience for everybody and whatever? So, you know, we've evolved. That was the thing, I should say that too. I think Janet Finn is really taken by this. And I'll just say it again, you know, probably because I am a biologist. To me, watching the work that we've done in Missoula evolve, you know, the feminist institutional model has evolved here, and our work just moves that way. And, you know, to me, that's a perfect model to think about things, because evolution is not about magic. It's about, you know, a response to environment and, you know, the movement from one, again, resource pool and possibility to another, and things just move and evolve. And but you're alive. And as soon as, you know, you can't, you know, move and evolve, you're not alive anymore. And that's the trick, I think, about a lot of these things, is to keep them there.
Can I ask you one more thing? Can you just briefly, if possible, list the organizations and things that you helped to start in Missoula that you can remember?
Well, I'll give you the official ones that are like institutions, and then there have been lots, because the other way I like to work is I like to put together groupings. So, like, there was the Resource Center, and there was Women's Place, and there was Blue Mountain, and there was Word. But then there's some groupings, too. Like, we did the Women in Technology for a while. We did the Incest Prevention Coalition for a while. We did the Welfare Reform Coalition for a while. I'm in MISC right now, which is the Montana Income Support Collaboration. We did ARC, At-Risk Housing Collaboration. So to me, that's the model I work in, is to bring together people and sort of see what can happen out of that. So again, the institutions that have really stayed around, the Resource Center is still here, which I'm glad. Women's Place, unfortunately, isn't still here, but there's a whole history as to why that's true and mm-hmm. various things happened there. Blue Mountain is still here. Certainly Word is still here. You know, those are the ones that I mainly think of as the institutions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this.
Sure.